From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
Education is a cornerstone of former State Superintendent of Public Instruction Delaine Easton's gubernatorial campaign. Before we hear her views on education and other issues facing the next governor, we thought it might make sense to take a look back at an earlier program we did on the price of education in California. Those conversations in a moment.
The state's total education budget will likely be over $70 billion next fiscal year, up a whopping 50% since 2011. California now spends $3,800 more per child than it did during the depths of the Great Recession. That's $14,500 per student this year, compared to about $10,700 in 2011. So why is California still near the bottom in per pupil spending among states? And why are educators saying they'll have difficulty balancing their budgets going forward? We'll ask Judy Lynn, a reporter with Cal Matters, who's written extensively on the price of K-12 education in California.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, and by Kaiser Permanente. Thrive. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Recently, Cal Matters, a nonprofit, nonpartisan media venture that explains California's politics and policies, ran a series on the price of education. We're fortunate to have the reporter who wrote that series, Judy Lynn. Welcome to the Matty Report.
Thank you for having me.
So the last few years, it seems like public schools have been big winners in the governor's annual budget. How big?
They're big winners because we have an increasingly improving economy. We've seen an infusion of extra taxes from Proposition 30, and that's meant that
Proposition 30 was the temporary tax that's going to be supposedly phased out.
Yes, yes. Okay. That was approved by voters in 2012, mm-hmm. and Jerry Brown campaigned for it. And now this year's school budget is $71.6 billion. That's a 50% increase from 2011.
That's a big jump. School districts are very happy to see that, I'm sure.
Yes.
And that also means that the per pupil spending has increased quite a bit as well. I was reading your articles. You said that it's increased by $3,800 per pupil. That's a lot of money. So it wasn't that long ago that school districts were handing out pink slips. It seems that situation has completely reversed itself. What impact are these bigger budgets having on teacher pay?
They're going up. In short, their schools that once handed out tens of thousands of pink slips are now trying to lure teachers with bonuses, pay bonuses. They're getting increases in merit raises and trying to make sure that their staff is now that can be rebuilt.
Because they let these people go and now they say, gee, we have this need. And my understanding is that the salary has gone up 10.6% in the last 6 years. Now, that sounds kind of good, but that's actually lower than the rate of inflation. And so, yes, but.
Yes.
So how do California's teachers' salaries rank when you're taking a look at teacher salaries nationwide?
We're very much in the top tier. Our average salary, according to the Department of Education, is about $74,000. And if you look at that, that puts us in with New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts. That's a high cost area region, and that's what we need to stay competitive.
Is that really what's driving this? That California, most areas of the state, is pretty high cost of living. $74,000 sounds like a lot, but in some places it's difficult to survive on that. Is that what's driving these higher salaries in California?
Very much so. You look at the Bay Area, San Francisco in particular, $74,000 of an average teacher salary may not get you the best housing or in a safe neighborhood.
It's interesting. I have a friend whose children live in San Francisco, and they're living downtown, $4,000 a month in rent. So you start thinking about these $50,000 you're spending just on rent alone. $74,000 doesn't go very far in a place like the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about California compared to other states in terms of per pupil spending. How are we doing there?
Not as well. We are ranked in the bottom third by different measures. If you look at just the numbers, we're at 36th. In compared to the 50 states in Washington, D.C. If you look at a report that's put out by Education Weekly, we're 46th in the nation in per pupil spending.
That's near the bottom. I mean, yeah. California for a long time was kind of near the bottom in terms of per pupil spending. There's more money now, so it's getting a little better, but we're still
very
bottom
much
10.
So. Yeah, and that's because of the regional cost differences, just what it costs to live in California.
Is also what's driving that, what's the breakout of that? So we have high teacher salaries, yet low per pupil spending. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking that means larger classrooms.
Exactly. If you look at what's happening is argue that we don't invest enough in education, that we score low, if you look at the Quality Counts report, when it comes to how much taxable resources as a state that we spend on education.
It's kind of amazing. When you take a look at the state budget, about 40% of the state budget goes to K-12 and community college education. That is a sizable chunk. I think that surprises a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of people think, the majority of state spending is on corrections or something like that. That's not the case at all, is it?
No, and that's largely due to Proposition 98, which sets a guarantee for school funding. It's very much a protection measure for schools.
And that's a pretty complicated measure. And Prop 98, I mean, we can get into that, I suppose, but that's a very complicated measure in terms of how schools get their financing, but it's mandated, isn't it?
It is. We passed it in 1988, and it's a complex formula, but the thrust of it is easy. It's just to make sure that we're adequately supporting schools and community colleges.
Yeah, the thrust of it is easy, but the devil is in the details, right? Well, thank you for that overview of education spending in California. Up next, despite low pure pupil spending, public education still commands a lion's share of the state budget, as we discussed. Where's that money coming from? Next on the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're speaking with Judy Lin, a reporter with Cal Matters, who recently wrote a series of articles on the price of education in California. You know, as noted earlier, California schools are experiencing a dramatic growth in revenue, but where is all this money coming from? Clearly part of this is Prop 30, as we talked about a little earlier. It's had a big impact on state funding for schools. So first, can you remind our audience exactly what the voters approved when they approved Prop 30?
Sure. If you remember, 2012 was a big year. We're still reeling from the recession. Governor Brown went up and down the state across school campuses and campaigned for what was Proposition 30. The premise was simple. It was a temporary tax. We raised the sales tax by a quarter cent. And then we also increased the personal income tax for 7 years on high-income earners. And it was a progressive model, went from $250,000 to $1 million at progressively higher rates.
Yeah. The sales tax, though, someone argues that's kind of a regressive tax. It falls more harshly, you could say, on lower-income people than higher-income people. It's a bigger part of their mm-hmm. disposable income. So that phased out after 4 years. And then we've got the income tax part of it's going to be going on for a few more years. Then that's eventually going to phase out. How much money was that bringing in?
Sure. Together, the two pots brought in about $8 billion more a year, which is about $1.5 billion came from the sales tax. And this 2016 is the last year we'll have that in effect. About $6 or $7 billion is coming from the personal income tax, and you'll see that starting to phase out by the end of 2018.
Yeah, it's interesting. California, their revenue structure really is focused on personal income taxes. I think about two-thirds of the state's revenue comes from personal income taxes, a lot. And a lot of that, frankly, is on high wage earners.
Yes.
Not high wage earners. That's actually a mistake. Probably it's on people who have capital gains, stock market, that kind of thing, when they're selling stocks, and they pay a lion's share of it. So, obviously, the improving economy has had a big impact on generating revenue there. But you were saying $8 billion. It's interesting, that figure. We were running about $6 to $8 billion deficits when this thing came in, and all of a sudden we're no longer a deficit. And really, a lot of people can point to Prop 30.
Yes, it's
probably the reason why we're not running deficits, at least weren't before. Yeah. Now we're running surpluses. So let's talk about the improving economy. The impact it's had on school funding because of Prop 98's minimum guarantee. I don't want to get too much into the weeds on Prop 98. We did a show earlier on Prop 98, and someone was saying that the person who designed it actually put his kids through college explaining Prop 98. It's so complicated. Winchester Mystery House, for those people who drive to the Bay Area and see that on Route 152. So what is Prop 98? How does that exactly work, that minimum guarantee work?
It is a formula that sets an annual funding level for K-12 schools and community colleges. It's determined by three measures, and the goal of it is to track with the growth of the economy and with the number of students. So that's the really basic premise.
And there's all kinds of complicated formulas, though, to make that happen, right?
Yes, yeah, three test cases. One is a percentage of the general fund, one is the percentage of the economy, and I may get it wrong.
Yeah, well, there's a number of things. The bottom line is you better be a math major if you're going to put this together, because it's extremely complicated. And the other thing, too, is interesting, is that it's based on past revenues, right? So let's say in the previous year you had a good revenue stream, but now in the next year you don't. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. You've got to be paying based on what you received coming in prior. So that just it makes it very, very challenging. In addition to this new funding, though, there's a new set of policies that's been adopted to improve academic outcomes. First of all, I was wondering, how big are the academic differences between various ethnic and racial groups? Is it a big divide?
Very much so. There's what a lot of educators call the academic achievement gap. This is where you see Latinos and African American students on standardized testing having less proficiency and not passing compared to white students. In the latest, most recent batch of standardized tests, less than 1 in 4 low-income and Latino children and less than 1 in 5 African-American children scored high enough to be proficient in math.
20-25% means, 75-80% are not proficient.
Yeah.
Those are big numbers. So states tried to address this problem by introducing something called the Local Control Funding Formula, LCFF. A lot easier to write it that way. What is the Local Control Funding Formula? How does it address that imbalance?
Sure. The idea is that we are dramatically throwing out our previous model, where the state was very much dictating how to school districts how you should spend your money. But Governor Brown, in his effort to push things to the local level, wanted to give discretion to districts. So he created this formula, and it basically is doles out a base amount to every school, and on top of that, if it gives additional funds.
So if you have low income or English as a second language, you get a little bump.
Yes.
Extra money. Yeah, it's interesting. The previous way they did it is they actually earmarked the funds. This money's for this. This money's for that. Now they're saying, use it for whatever you think is appropriate. Apparently, school districts then can use it for whatever they want. They don't even have to report back to the state as to how they're spending the money. There's a question. Is that money getting into those classrooms that need that money?
We don't know, and that is definitely a red flag. As San Diego Assemblywoman Shirley Weber is saying, we can hope that the intent of it is good. But given that it's a new formula, it's only been in a year or two, we don't know what measurable results. No. And keep in mind, Governor Brown, in his maintaining his philosophy on local control, doesn't necessarily want to know.
Yeah, so that's going to be very interesting. Wow, thank you for that explanation of education funding in California. So up next, how are those education dollars actually being spent? Do we really know? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. With California's school budget up more than 50%, why are educators saying that they're having difficulty balancing their budgets going forward? We're talking with Judy Lin, a reporter with Cal Matters, who's written extensively on the price of education in California. So educational administrators are pointing to unfunded pension liability. How big is the unfunded pension liability in K-12 education?
Yeah, at the last marker from last June was $67 billion for unfunded pension liabilities. And this is for about 880,000 currently active and retired teachers and administrators, certified employees.
It's interesting. Pensions are supposed to be, actuarially sound. So actuarially sound, I'll make sure I say that correctly. The money coming in is supposed to be enough to pay for the things going out. How did the system, the teachers' retirement system, get so out of whack?
It was built up over years when the economy was doing well. The state and local school districts basically didn't contribute as much because we were actuarially sound. The economy, the stock markets, their investments were showing strength and
so we figured that would go on forever.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen. If anybody invests in the stock market with a 401k, they know it goes up and down.
Mm-hmm.
There was an agreement in 2014 with the governor and the legislature on how to eliminate this debt over the next 30 years. What was in that agreement?
Yeah, so Governor Brown and lawmakers passed this long-term payment plan, and it ramps up the school district contributions from 8.25% of payroll to 19.1%.
Whoa, that almost doubles
it. So it's more than double.
And yeah. that's by 2020, so,
yes.
So that's a big jump. They better have money set aside for that. Not so much the teachers themselves?
The teachers themselves are going up, but it ends up being capped, and the state also is increasing its contributions, but largely this is falling on school districts.
Okay, so what does that mean for the school district's bottom line?
It means that with all the extra money they've been getting from Proposition 30, it's going out to, it's being set aside to make sure they can pay for these benefits that have been promised to teachers.
Yeah, my understanding is, reading the LAO report, Legislative Analyst Report, says that the Prop 98 minimum guarantee would bring in about $8.3 billion more by the time this kicks in 2020. So, but a good chunk of that, $3 billion of that, is going to be paying for this unfunded liability. So a pretty big chunk.
Yeah, 38% was my finding.
Yeah, they're not getting that whole $8 billion. They're going to only get a portion of that.
Yeah.
You've written that the situation actually may be worse than that. You're saying that there is a high return on investment assumed with the money being set aside for the pension fund for investments. Can you explain?
Yeah. So the pension system, they project out, there are assumptions of how much their investments will raise and in interest. And
so the idea behind the system is we're going to put some money aside to pay for the retirement, but we're also going to invest that money. And so that investment income will also pay. So the overall cost won't be so much on the retiree.
Yeah. And that's a 7.5% assumption rate in the California teachers.
So they're assuming a 7.5% return on investment on those pension funds.
Yes, yes.
Sounds pretty good. I think a lot of people would like to get 7.5% on their return.
Their 20-year return has been above that, but they are moving to be more cautious. The CalSTRS, the Teachers Retirement System Board, is considering whether or not they should make adjustments to that.
But when they lower the rate of return, assumed, that means they're going to have to ask people to put more money in to make up that difference, correct?
Yeah.
I mean, well, in school districts, so then even a bigger hit. Which
yes.
is what your point, I think the point is of your article.
Yes,
yes. So there's also, add another problem to the mix here, and that's the issue of retiree health care. How big a problem is that, and is there any money being set aside to deal with those future obligations? So it's not just the pension, it's also the retiree health.
Yeah, so there was a recent report by State Controller Betty Yee that pegged the whole state state costs for retiree health and dental benefits at $74 billion.
That's the entire?
Entire, yeah.
That's not just teachers, that's everybody.
That's everybody, okay. All state workers. But to put it in perspective, the state is setting aside $1.9 billion, mm-hmm. and she's saying they should actually be putting aside $5 billion.
Wow.
So
20% of what they should be setting aside, 80% is not being covered.
Because of our pay as you go system,
right,
that we have.
Right. Well, thank you. That's a good picture of the current obligations and how they may determine how education dollars are going to be spent in the future. Up next, Prop 30's temporary tax planned to end by 2020. Will it be needed? Will it be needed to be extended to ensure adequate education funding in the future? That conversation in a moment. This is the Mattie Report. Welcome back. Governor Brown has been warning about an economic downturn for some time. If a recession were to occur, what impact would it have on school funding? We're talking to Judy Lin with Cal Matters about the price of education in California. Although the governor and the legislative analyst are not forecasting an economic slowdown, you just got to look at the numbers. And over the last five recessions, the economic recoveries lasted about 68 months. Well, in February of 2016, we're at that 68th month. So the question is, if we get a recession or some kind of economic downturn, what impact is that going to have on school funding?
Yeah, that line that you think of a chart keep going up, it's going to go down and then maybe recover a little bit, so you end up maybe flat. The legislative analyst's office has done a projection to 2019, and they're saying if we go into a recession, the education budget will dip down and then end up right back at $71 billion, which is where we are now.
Right, right. Okay, so not surprisingly, school groups like the California Teachers Association, the California Federation of Teachers, the state PTA, a lot of them, are pushing for an extension of those Prop 30 temporary taxes that are scheduled to expire. So what exactly are they proposing and how much money would it generate?
Yeah, so they definitely want to let the sales tax portion expire. They think that the burden...
Because that impacts everyone.
Yeah.
As opposed to the higher income tax that only impacts higher income people.
They think they can get more votes that way.
That is usually what happens with taxes, isn't it, right? I mean, tobacco tax. If it affects someone else, I'm going to vote for it. If it affects me, maybe not so much. How much is that going to generate if it passed?
Yeah, and so it's very much an extension of what the governor had done in Prop 30. And so it would just continue to bring in, maybe $8 billion more a year. And most of that would go to schools.
Yeah, it's serious money in the billions. What if the tax isn't extended? Then what?
Then we're very much at the whim of the economy, because of our volatile budget structure. It will
a heavy reliance on capital gains, right? Because a big reliance on personal income tax, particularly at the higher levels, and that's capital gains. And so if the stock market goes down, there goes the revenue.
Yes.
Is that basically the problem?
That's basically it.
So let's say we have a double whammy. There is no extension of the Prop 30 temporary taxes, mm-hmm. And there's a recession. Then what?
Then we take that double hit. It's about the way we did some forecasting and projections based on LAO numbers is we're looking at a difference of $12 billion. And that's, a good 16%, if not more, of our current spending on education.
A $12 billion hit.
Yeah.
Wow. So what do you think? Do you think that this extension is going to get on the November ballot? And what do you think the chances are that it'll actually pass?
That is up to the voters. I would never claim to know the mood of the voters. It is headed for the ballot in November.
Okay.
It's a crowded ballot, but it will be on there. You have a wide coalition of teachers unions, parent groups, even hospitals and doctors are on board. So they're out collecting signatures.
But they've
right
got to collect 585,000 signatures by June 30th.
Yes. So, and get it cleared and validated.
Okay, but the point is too that do you think they'll do it? You think they're actually going to hit that target?
Yes, yes, it's very doable.
But there's some opposition out there. This is not going to sail through. The governor, for example, has said that the current proposal has a fatal flaw, that it doesn't have the state's rainy day fund as part of the equation. Is that going to tube this? Is that going to send it down into flames?
No. So in the campaign genius, they the organizers of this tax extension went in and modified their rainy day proposal to make Brown happy. It now sets aside money as he intended into the rainy day.
And it's also going to be a presidential election, your higher voter turnout, typically more Democrats vote, and then maybe have a better chance of passing. Let me ask you a last issue about school construction. There was recently a $9 billion bond proposal that's being floated. The governor seems to oppose that as well. Why does the governor oppose that?
He is very much of the mindset that the program is flawed. It's not that he doesn't support construction. It's that the way it is constructed allows the more well-organized, affluent districts to get...
Because they've already got things in the pipeline, on the shelf, ready to go, and the poor districts don't. Is that basically the problem?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Judy Lynn from Cal Matters for joining us. If you want to stay current on state and local politics, you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook, or log on to our website at MattyInstitute.org and sign up for Mattie Daily, our free e-newsletter.
Education is a hallmark of Delaine Easton's campaign for governor. How would she address that and other issues facing the state? That conversation in a moment.
You're listening to the Mattie Report, Valley Views Edition, on KMJ.
With Governor Jerry Brown termed out in 2018, the race is on to replace him. And while the focus has been on two former big city mayors, former San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom and former LA Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, the former state superintendent of public instruction, Delaine Easton, the only woman in the race, is beginning to draw attention. Could California elect its first female governor in 2018? A discussion with candidate for governor, Delaine Easton.
Additional funding for the Mattie Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. Chevron's Coalinga oil field and Fresno County have been doing side by side for over 100 years. Learn more at doers.com. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Mattie Institute, it's the Mattie Report with Executive Director of the Mattie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Jerry Brown terms out in 2018. The only woman who is a major party candidate is our guest, Delaine Easton, the former superintendent of public instruction. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be here.
So, why do you want to be governor?
Well, I've traveled the entire state of California. I've been to all 58 counties. And what I'm seeing is growing inequality in the state. We have some areas of really substantial wealth, but we have some terribly poor areas, especially in the Valley of California. And the great equalizer for dealing with that problem is called education. Mm-hmm. The reason California got the Silicon Valley here in the first place wasn't a confluence of rivers. We have no Tigris. We have no Euphrates. What we had was an amazing opportunity for people to get educated. Great K-12 schools, the most incredible university and community college system the world has ever seen. And somehow we stepped away from that. We've dropped to 41st in per pupil spending, and we're number one in per prisoner expenditure. Along with that, though, we haven't been building housing so that working class families can actually afford to own their own home. We have these vast commutes people are making. You know, we're on the front page of the New York Times about a woman who's living in Stockton and working in the Bay Area because she can't afford to live there.
And that's not that unusual.
No. The commutes are astounding right now.
You know, to create this vision of California that you have, it's going to cost money. So where's the money going to come from?
Well, you know, budgets are statements of values. When you're 41st in per pupil spending and number one in per prisoner expenditure, you have to reorganize a little bit.
You know, I want to go back and just go back to that initial statement you made that budgets are statement of values. I mean, it really is. You can talk all you want, but show me the money, right?
Well, show me the money. But in truth, you know, we have the highest paid prison guards and the fewest number of prisoners per guard of any state. So we've larded up the prison system while we've been sacrificing K-12 education and higher education, and I would argue even preschool. So at the end of the day, right now, California needs to revisit some things. For one thing, we really do need to have a conversation about commercial industrial properties. When Prop 13 passed, it was envisioned that when 50% plus one of the stock turned over, those buildings and those businesses would be reassessed. But Board of Equalization ruled they weren't going to do that. So right now, commercial industrial property, much of it, even though it has technically changed hands because of more than 50% of the stock turned over, is being taxed at 1978 levels. And so we can get more additional resources into this system for education if we make an adjustment in Prop 13 as it relates to commercial industrial property.
There's also the supermajority that's required to pass taxes. Now, it's different for education. It's 55%. But for most other local taxes, it's a two-thirds majority under Prop 13.
55% to build the buildings. To staff the building is 66 and two-thirds. And that, I would argue, is unfair. And a recent ruling was made by one of the judges that said, essentially, if 50% plus one of the people initiate something and it goes on the ballot, it should be a simple majority vote. We have to do something to make it easier to fix the schools. I live in Davis, where we have four parcel taxes at one time on our houses because it's a university town.
Right.
But Woodland and West Sacramento need the money as much or more than Davis. They can't get a two-thirds vote. So we need to do something to make sure our kids are getting a great education in this global economy.
Well, let me ask you this, and we'll talk more in detail about those a little bit later, some of the specific things, but I want to ask you about this difference in California. I mean, California is pretty much a democratically controlled state as opposed to the Republicans. The Democrats have a 19% majority over Republicans in terms of registration, and it looks likely it's going to be a Democrat-on-Democrat gubernatorial race.
It probably will be.
So. You've said, this is a quote which I found interesting, California needs a governor with a brass backbone, and that's why I'm running. So why do you think you have more of a brass backbone than the others who are running in the race?
Well, I mean, you can see the waffling on certain issues. They talk about being environmentalists, but not one of them has come out to ban fracking. I'm the only candidate that says we should ban fracking. We had earthquakes before they were fashionable. We know what they're like. And besides that, it's putting polluted water into our groundwater. It's the dumbest thing I've ever seen California do. So, you know, I will stand up to big tobacco, big pharma, big oil. I'm not accepting money from any of them. And the truth be known, you know, I was the honorary co-chair of both Prop 99 and Prop 10, which taxed tobacco products. And when a lot of the boys were kind of wringing their hands and not really stepping out to be in support of those ideas.
Well, let me ask you this. How would you differentiate yourself from traditional Democratic positions? Are there any positions that you're taking that aren't considered traditional Democratic positions? You could throw in, for example, high-speed rail. Generally, Democrats support it. Republicans don't. Where are you on that issue?
Well, my biggest concern with high-speed rail is I want to identify a revenue stream. I don't want to fund it out of the general fund of the state of California. So, you know, Jerry has done that somewhat with his cap-and-trade redirection. I think that we have to have an honest conversation, though, or it's going to be a train only the very wealthiest of people are going to be able to ride because the tickets will be so expensive. So find a revenue stream. It could be, you know, an oil severance tax. It could be a lot of things. But find a revenue stream and build it because it's good for the environment as well as being good for modern transportation.
Okay, up next, we're going to talk about two of the hottest issues in state politics, at least in the last year, and that is affordable housing and infrastructure. Think roads and water for California's growing population. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with former State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Delaine Easton. She's also running for governor in 2018. So let's talk about some current issues the state is dealing with. One is affordable housing. That's been a big issue. It's been in the news. It seems like there's one or two ways to deal with this issue. One way you can deal with it is spend your way out of the problem, either with bonds or tax credits, bringing back redevelopment agencies. Second way you could deal with the problem is focus on regulatory reform, amending things like CEQA to free the private sector to build more houses. What do you think should be done here?
The problem is so big that you have to do everything. Yeah. You have to bring back redevelopment. In Union City, when I was on the city council, we used redevelopment agency money to buy Pacific State Steel, Liquid Air, and the PG&E pipe storage yard. They were all polluted. We cleaned them with the redevelopment money, and now we're building affordable and market-rate housing. And they're multi-story, but they're right next to the BART station. People love it because they can literally walk to the BART train and get on it without having to move their car.
Transit-oriented development is what it's referred
exactly.
to. And as the population ages, interesting too, there's also this tsunami of, we're going to talk a little bit about senior population. They can't drive. They need to be close, some of them, or prefer to walk or take mass transit. So some of this transit-oriented development is pretty interesting. But that was a $2 billion hit on the general fund. I mean, that's why they got rid of it during the budget crisis. Can we afford to go back and have RDAs?
I think we have got to have RDAs. And honestly, Jerry Brown used them extensively when he was mayor of Oakland. We use them extensively in Union City. Other communities have used them too. It's time for us to understand that we do have areas of the state that we can and should be redeveloping along much more progressive lines. So yes, CEQA needs to be updated, but we also need to give people incentive to build housing. And then we've got to make it near transportation hubs because people are going these vast distances to work. And let's face it, a couple, he might be going north, she might be going south. They're not all going the same place. So finding a way to do more housing around transportation hubs is important. But one of the big things that's missing in California right now is long-range planning. You know, the state of California makes every city and county have a long-range plan. Mm-hmm. So I get to the legislature and I say, I'd like to see the long-range plans. Everybody looks at me like I'm crazy. Finally, I get to water and they say, well, we have a long-range plan. It was done under Governor Brown, Pat Brown, 1957.
That was a few years ago.
Yeah, and so one of the reasons we have a problem at Oroville is nobody's been minding the store. We have serious concerns and problems at not just in terms of our dams. Last year was a record rainfall. Most of that water ran into the ocean. We should have had a plan for capturing
it. I want to get a few other questions here about infrastructure. One is highways and roads. You just had this transportation tax that's going to be $5.2 billion a year to improve transportation. Was it needed?
I think it was needed. I mean, years ago, I begged the legislature to benchmark gas taxes to the cost of gas. Because when our parents were making California the amazing state that it is, they were paying about a quarter of what they paid for a tank of gas on taxes to build the famous California freeway system. And we taxes didn't go up as the cost of gas went up. And so we were still spending this minuscule amount of money, what at the time was in the 50s and 60s was a lot of money, now became really minor. And, you know, if it hadn't been for 23 different counties passing half-cent sales taxes, Fresno was one of the first.
Right.
You would see Santa Clara was first, Fresno and Alameda were second. But we've had 23 now. Imagine how bad everything is. It would be a lot worse if we hadn't had local agencies step up.
Yeah, that was a big selling point on a lot of these counties when they passed these self-help taxes. Let me ask you about water. That's another one of these big infrastructure issues. So the question is, you know, we just went through a bad drought. Do we need more dams? What about the governor's Delta plan? Where are you on water issues?
Well, I'm a big believer that California does need a long-range plan for water, and it can't be dated 1957. So we need to update our plan on water. Before we talk about twin tunnels, which this public turned down peripheral canal, 80% of the people said no to the peripheral canal.
That was, you know, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, but if you just because you put a lid on it, it's still a peripheral canal. The twin tunnels, I don't think, are good for the San Francisco Bay and Delta, and I think we could capture a lot more water if we had a plan for reclaiming water when it fell from the sky as it did in record amounts last year. We could reclaim it, we could store it. We don't have a lot of locations we could build many more dams in California. The very best locations have been taken. But we have other things we can do to store our water and other
ways. So I want to make sure I understand you. Are you saying like Temperance and sites should not be built? Those dams should not be built?
I'm saying I think the couple of dams that are in process right now can be built. But there are the idea that we're going to build a lot more dams is impractical.
So,
there just aren't that many locations.
So are you focusing on groundwater banking?
I'm focusing on groundwater banking, and I'm focusing on recycling, reclamation. I'm focusing on conservation generally.
Okay. Well, up next, we're going to see where Delaine Easton stands on perennial issues like crime, poverty, jobs, and education. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Hepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking to former State Superintendent of Public Instruction Delaine Easton, who's running for governor in California in 2018. So let's talk about an issue that's uppermost in a lot of people's minds, and that's public safety. Long-term crime trends seem to be going down, though there has been a recent tick up in some crime statistics. Is that just an anomaly, a one-off situation, or is this the start of some kind of trend?
You know, we do have we've had a big improvement in our crime trends in California overall, and I really do hope that we can continue to improve that. But the secret to lowering crime is increasing education. All the research teaches us that. We have the finest public research institutions in the world in California, and they tell us that the kids that get comprehensive preschool and child development opportunities, get a good K-12 education, are far less likely to wind up in the criminal justice system. It's pay me now or pay me later. So I'd rather pay for education than pay for incarceration. And I do think we have an opportunity in California to greatly improve the quality of life for people that are at the margins.
So you're not, at this point, you don't see a trend going in the wrong direction?
I don't. I really hope we're going to continue on the trend that is lower crime rate. That the, you know, being in jail is a terrible thing, and it's a waste of a lot of money on the part of the citizenry.
Well, just to be fair to and make sure I'm saying the statistics correctly, is yes, there's been an uptick, but it's still dramatically less than it was in the 60s. So just to put it in perspective, let's talk about poverty and some of those issues that kind of lead to crime. The PPIC, the Public Policy Institute of California, says almost 4 in 10 Californians are living in or near poverty. And if you take a look at places like the Valley, that number is even greater. So, you know, then there's the issue of the senior population that's increasing, the silver tsunami. A lot of them don't have money set aside for retirement. So one of the things that's been proposed, something called Secure Choice, which is an idea to create a state-administered pension plan for private employees. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a great idea. I think there's some things California needs to do to be more nimble generally. So I like this idea of creating a private pension plan. I also like the idea that California would have a public bank, that we would do more things independent as the state of California. Because I'm nervous, as many people are, about what's happening in Washington, D.C. The current administration does seem to be, you know, taking us backward in a lot of different areas, and there's no progress being made on anything that I can see. So I really want to see California reinvest in thinking about tomorrow. And that means, you know, we're going to live longer than any people have ever lived in the history of the world. The fastest growing age group is over 100. And so having an opportunity for people to have a pension and to have a good quality of life in their senior years is really important.
Yeah, the people are concerned that could be the new group where poverty really greatly expands. But let me ask you about this two-tier economy. A lot of people talk about that. You know, the coastal part of California doing very well. Inland California, not so much. You know, you see unemployment rates twice as high in the Valley as they are in the Bay Area. In fact, 8 of the 10 metro areas with the worst unemployment nationally are in California. So what needs to be done to correct this economic imbalance?
Well, I think California needs to do a full court press on thinking about how we do improve life in the Valley. One of the things that is the hallmark of high unemployment rates and high poverty rates is lack of education. And so why aren't we having a conversation about building new community colleges, new CSUs, and even another UC in the rural, more remote parts of our state? I visited schools in all 58 counties. I can't tell you how many educators said to me, our kids don't tend to go to college because it's too far to go. It's just too big a commute. So why aren't we? The land is less expensive there. We would create good paying jobs, not only building the buildings, but staffing the buildings after they're built. And we'd give our rural, remote communities a better chance at a great education and a great future.
Yeah, there's a PPIC study that came out that said only 30% of the students in California high schools are going to make it all the way through to college, which is a startling statistic and a real problem for the state. But and it seems like a lot of your answers, frankly, to some of the issues that plague the state really come back to education.
Well, that same PPIC report actually said that the CSU turned away 69,000 students who were qualified and wanted to go to CSU.
We could have gotten in if there had been a place for them.
Well, and that's bigger than the entire college student population of a state like North Dakota or Idaho or Wyoming. The reality is that's an army of young people that wanted an education that couldn't get in.
Well, that's 3 Fresno states, if you want to put it in perspective. I want to ask you about the students are trying to get through school, whether it's, you know, English as a second language. There's 1.4 million of those. Latino students make up more than half of California's public school population. How do we prepare them for the 21st century?
Well, first we have to get them more preschool, and then we have to understand that, you know what you call somebody who speaks three languages? Trilingual. Somebody who speaks two languages? Bilingual. Somebody who speaks one language? American. And so we need to have much more of an emphasis on multiple languages for the people of this state. My niece went through a dual language immersion program in San Jose, River Glen. Mm-hmm. She was fluent in Spanish. She introduced me at the California Association of Bilingual Educators in the third grade in perfect Spanish. And she went on to learn French in high school, Russian in college. Now she's taking Finnish lessons at the Finnish embassy.
Wait, think of the advantage of that. I mean, my family's from Switzerland, and so if you're Swiss, you've got to learn Italian, French, English, German, and so you've come out pretty far ahead there. You know, we're going to talk a little more about some of the issues plaguing California and what we can do to address those issues with California gubernatorial candidate Delaine Easton in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Hepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking to California gubernatorial candidate and former state superintendent of public instruction Delaine Easton. Let's talk about some of the long-term issues confronting California. If you're elected the next governor, we got the issue of immigration. How do you feel about the way this is being addressed, whether it's DACA, the Dreamers, sanctuary cities? What should California be doing in this area?
Well, I support sanctuary cities and a sanctuary state. I mean, the truth is most of us who live here are immigrants. Our families may have come five generations ago, as my mother's side of the family did, or they may have come just this last generation, as my dad did. He was from Kentucky. He loved to say, Californians are people born somewhere else who came to their senses. Nobody loved California more than he did. And so I think we ought to see our immigrants as a great asset, and we ought to celebrate their presence. They help to keep us fresh. Immigrants are the most ambitious, entrepreneurial, risk-taking people on earth, and we have been, I think, made a more nimble state because we have a large immigrant population.
Let's talk about another big issue, and that is health care. Providing for health care and controlling the cost of health care, big issues. What's your prescription for fixing California's health care system?
I'm supporting single payer. I mean, California right now, we're spending more money and getting less health care. We have one of the most expensive health care systems in the world, and yet we have people dying or going bankrupt because our system is not well put together. So it needs a grown-up to going to step in and say, look, for less money, the rest of the world is giving their people better health care. Why don't we step up and do the right thing? Something like 70% of the cost of single payer is already being put out by the government in terms of our pay for Medicaid, Medicare, and for the folks that are getting served because they're public employees or retired public employees. That's 70% of the cost. And so if we step up and do the remainder, we can help people's health and we can help our future.
You know, I was actually looking up that statistic and those numbers, and it said almost half the population gets some kind of government health care already.
Yes.
Which is kind of interesting. But, you know, there are opponents to this SB 562, the single-payer plan. They're saying that, listen, there was no money in this proposal to pay for this. What's your response to that?
Well, I think you can redirect much of the public money that's going into it now. But the truth is, right now we've got a very expensive system that's costing bankrupting people. I had a doctor one time come and testify before the legislature that he'd just seen a 7-year-old boy who nearly died of an ear infection. Had 107 degrees of fever when he came to the hospital. They saved his life, but he went deaf in that ear. So the doctor's conclusion, it cost the state over $50,000 to save his life. He lost his hearing. And why? For $3 or $4 worth of antibiotics, his life could have been much improved and the state could have saved a lot of money.
Yeah, a lot of the focus on healthcare is preventive, a way to reduce costs, correct?
Right.
Are you concerned all about prescription drug prices?
I am worried about prescription drug prices. The fact is that, you know, somebody takes over another company and all of a sudden the EpiPen goes from being something like $25 to $600. The truth is a lot of the world does not allow the pharmaceutical industry to make that kind of profit on people that just need, you know, kind of routine medical support. We need to step up the regulation of big pharma in this state.
Let me ask you about another big issue, and that's climate change. And 97% of all, you know, NASA reviewed, actively published climate scientists said, listen, climate warming trends are man-made, or man-caused, or human-caused. But there are also studies that also that say that California really only contributes about 1% to the problem. So how would you balance addressing the issue of climate change with maintaining California's economy?
Well, I believe in science. There I said it. You know, the idea that we wouldn't listen to the climate scientists, 97% of whom agree on this subject, is crazy. And the cost to us, first, we have a huge $500 million fix at the Oroville Dam. We just had record fires because we had record heat followed by record rain. You know, somehow we have to come to grips with the fact that even though California isn't contributing as much, we still need to make steps to make sure that we're making our state safe. You know, rising sea levels will affect communities all up and down the coast of California. We need to have somebody who's nimble enough to say, what are we going to do? What can we learn from the people of Amsterdam about how they protect their coastline? What can we learn internationally? We have these fine universities in our state. Why don't we draw on their expertise to help us to improve things? And it won't hurt the quality of life. It'll improve the quality of life.
Well, let me ask you one last question. We've only got about a minute left in the segment, actually a little less, but I want to ask you about a big issue, and that's public employee pensions. People say that's kind of the thing that's waiting out there that could really hurt the state because of the liability associated with that. In addition, people don't really talk about public employee retiree health care. Those are big issues, and there was a study done that said if you add all the liability of state, local government together on these issues, we're talking like $366 billion. How are we going to fund that? How are we going to make sure that promise is kept?
Well, I think some grown-up has to be in the governor's office and really insist that we deal with this problem head-on, and that it may entail several changes in law. And very briefly, for example, I don't think you should get more than one public pension from the state of California. The fact is that many people have more than one. That's not in our best interest. So
you're willing to look at this issue?
I'm willing to look at it.
Okay. Well, I want to thank former State Superintendent of Public Instruction and gubernatorial candidate Delaine Easton for being with us. If you want to stay current with state and local politics, you can log on to our website at mattyinstitute.org. Thanks for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed in the Matty Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Matty Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Matty Report, visit our website at mattyinstitute.org.
The Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.